that and how much information to submit through that waiver documentation. So we do recommend that you take the waiver that we created, the waiver template that we created, which is just an Excel spreadsheet that lists it out, so that you can be specific for each individual candidate for whom you're issuing a waiver given the impact on their program for this semester. That doesn't mean that you on your own will be keeping additional files. So some of you might have a full waiver form that you've set up with the signatures and how you're evaluating all of that. Some of you might have electronic files. You know, folks have asked me if they should link to those electronic files in the waiver documentation you submit to us. We anticipate that what you're collecting on your end and you're keeping and housing within your own institution is going to be much more extensive than the information that you share with us via a basic Excel template. In terms of a couple of questions specific to the CAP, the Candidate Assessment of Performance, if you're using the online platform, I've mentioned this a couple of times, it was just before this call, having another conversation with IT around how to navigate the online platform when you can't close out all of the components within it. But we are anticipating having a way for you to be able to designate a cycle has ended as long as you've got that cover form and the summative evaluation. And you won't need to enter any additional information into those quote unquote missing components that would otherwise be recommended. So similarly, if you're using the paper form, you would have to have at least the cover form and the summative assessment in terms of the ratings and the evidence that you use to reach those ratings, but you don't need to have evidence for the rest if you've waived those based on other set of evidence that you have. And then there's some questions around these, like what do we actually put in the openings here for the total number of practicum hours or hours assumed full responsibility? This should be reflective of what you would normally consider total practicum hours or reflective of what you would consider full responsibility, regardless of if it's in person or if it's virtual. It should still be reflective of the kinds of activities that you would otherwise count for the practicum. And again, if you're waiving some of the hours, that's totally, totally fine. But the hours that you do ultimately include in there should be reflective of what they would normally have. So then there is a set of what do we do if my candidates are not ready? The big message here, again, is that we only want you to be endorsing your candidates for which you're confident in their readiness skills. Just a friendly reminder that once you endorse them, they're eligible for that initial license, which is valid for 5 years and can be extended for another 5. And so we want to really make sure that while you're being flexible and innovative in the ways in which you are ultimately assessing them and working with them to document that readiness, that you are still really thinking about that stamp of approval that you're giving them being reflective of them being ready for the license. In some cases, as we've heard from several of you, you're going to have candidates that are not ready. They aren't there, and regardless of what opportunities you're able to provide them this spring, it's just not enough to get them there, given what they would have otherwise had opportunities to engage in terms of practice and feedback if schools were still open. And so that would mean that you should not endorse them. It could still mean that they graduate without that endorsement, right? You don't endorse them for the license, but they might still graduate and get their degree, and you can continue determine whether you continue working with them beyond this as well. A couple of things to note here is that they might be eligible for their provisional license. So if they're worried about being able to get hired in the fall, that was something that they were actively working towards and planning on. If they have their bachelor's degree and if they've passed all of the required MTELs, that might be one route that you would want to talk about with them as you're advising them. You would not include any of these candidates in the waiver documentation that you submit to us. So that waiver data collection that we're asking for is only for folks for whom you're ultimately issuing an endorsement at the end of the semester or at the end of the summer, whatever end of kind of this time is for you. And so there were questions around what additional information do we need for those who are not yet ready. Since you're not issuing an endorsement for them, then we wouldn't need to have them captured in that documentation. And then there was another set of questions around practicum extensions and what do you do if someone just needs a little bit more time? That's absolutely within your authority to engage in conversation around and make decisions around what that practicum extension can look like. We encourage you, as always, to take it on a case-by-case basis. So in some cases, that might look like you closing out their cycle officially in CAP and saying, we assessed you, you are not yet ready to teach. We're going to close out this cycle. And in the future, maybe in the fall, maybe in the spring, maybe after they take some time off, you would reopen it and kind of capture everything again holistically that you would otherwise be looking for in that candidate assessment of performance. In other cases, someone might have been pretty close. They still didn't demonstrate it. You're still not comfortable with signing off on them and issuing an endorsement, but it's not that they have to go through an entire full new practicum experience. They might just need to fill some remaining gaps in order to help you with getting that confidence that you would need to endorse them. In which case, you can leave the CAP process open. If you use paper documentation, you use paper. If you use the online platform, it will just stay open. And then fill in the remaining gaps in the future. Again, I say in the future because it's along any timeline that you want to work within, given the situation with that individual. In some cases with paper forms, it might mean that you have one CAP form and some documentation for the first part of it, but then you have a secondary placement site for them and additional documentation. So the whatever combination of forms you need to make that happen, you can. And similarly, in CAP, you can work with whatever combination of forms needed, and we're happy to talk with you on a one-on-one if you need some support on that end. So I'm sorry, I'm not able to see the chat again. I messed up my technology on this end. So I'm going to keep going. We will have time for questions at the end. So keep noting your questions as you have them. I do think I saw Megan get on. So Megan, if there's something you want to pop in with and make sure that we're responding to right now, please do that. Otherwise, I'll kind of keep trucking along and then we'll pause. Okay, so this doesn't address what to do about candidates beyond this semester. I'm gonna come back to that in just a moment. So, well, I haven't forgotten about it. I'm just gonna come back to it in a moment. The next kind of set of questions was around program approval and ongoing expectations. So one thing I wanted to note is for those of you who have experienced our program approval process, we really focus at the organization level. And that is intentional for a lot of reasons, but in kind of reflecting around where we are currently in the situation, I was realizing that this is exactly why we wanted to, through this program approval process, make sure that we are really looking at the systems and structures that you all have in place at your institutions so that you're able to make decisions aligned with ensuring your educators are prepared to be effective, especially when we're in situations like this where there needs to be pivots and flexibility, but really ensuring that as an institution, you're set up with the authority and responsibility to be able to respond in the ways that are needed and continue engaging in those ongoing continuous improvement processes, monitoring your impact, collecting the data that you need to, really understanding the extent to which any of these shifts and pivots you've had to make are yielding what you were hoping that they would. So we are going to continue to work with organizations under review to determine the appropriate timelines in terms of formal review process. We've been working one-on-one with organizations, but there's still just some unknowns in terms of what's going to happen in the fall. So we're appreciating their working with us as we determine extensions or what needs to happen, but that's going to continue being an ongoing conversation as the situation continues to unfold. So again, I'll just put out there, if you were up for review, there are a few organizations that we were supposed to have visited this spring that didn't happen, or those who are in the next year's docket. If you have additional questions that we haven't yet addressed with you, please just reach out to us and we'll connect around them. And then in terms of all other ongoing expectations that we have of you as approved institutions, we ask that you continue being innovative and flexible in the ways that you need to, making sure that you're being supportive as much as you can to your students, to your staff. We know that there's a lot to be heeding notice to and paying attention to while maintaining that high bar of expectations. We certainly don't want to negatively impact our pipeline into the educator profession in any negative way right now. Our kiddos need excellent teachers and leaders, and we're just really proud to be working alongside you to help ensure that they're getting that, and want to continue to thank you and reiterate that that expectation for what's needed for kids, especially in moments like this, continues to be there. And so ask that you continue engaging in the ways that you need to at your institution in order to be able to well support them. Acknowledging at the same time, there are tons of constraints and challenges with that. So part of that, again, some questions that came up, hopefully, which were answered largely in the guidance that we issued on Friday evening, but it's around the subject matter knowledge and pre-practicum guidelines that you all have been working towards over the past couple of years. So the big headliner here is, please keep actively working towards implementing these expectations as slowly as possible and as soon as possible. These expectations, we believe, really do two things strongly. One, with the subject matter knowledge in particular, it helps to even more deeply align what's happening in educator preparation with what teachers are going to be expected to do once they're hired into pre-K-12 settings. By grounding our SMK guidelines in the Massachusetts curriculum frameworks, it's signaling that teachers need to really know and understand what is within those curriculum frameworks. And by acknowledging that progression of subject matter knowledge from a basic to a functional to a fluent level in that initial licensure process is demonstrating that those teachers are well prepared to well teach those standards to kids. There's been so much in the news lately and conversations around what's going to happen for kids who are not getting access to learning right now. Their learning is interrupted in a variety of different ways. And the more fluent that our educators are with what the standards entail, what they mean, how do you continue to meet kids where they are to take them to where they need to be and engaging in meaningful ways? And that level of content fluency is really what, again, those subject matter knowledge guidelines and the pre-practicum guidelines, which is pushing for more practice and feedback and demonstration of that content-specific pedagogy together is going to help collectively lead your educators to get there. So as much as possible, keep doing the great work you've been doing to get there. And if you're already ready, submit your statement of assurance and your cross-cutting matrices in August. I wanted to note here that we understand that pre-practicum might not fully go according to plan next year, assuming that schools might be closed on and off and what that might look like. So things might not fully play out the way that you had planned. But if you have the processes in place, the structures in place in terms of your coursework and the gateways that you're using, please don't delay. Try to implement them as much as possible. There was a question that came in around keeping syllabi on file that address each of the SMKs. We don't require that you do that. So if you want to as an institution, you're certainly welcome to, but that's not something that we require you to have on file. If, for those of you who are not yet ready to implement it, also, we understand that. We heard that loud and clear, and as a result of hearing those concerns from you, have issued this additional level of flexibility so that if you're not ready, just let us know. What we're really trying to understand in this and the plan that we're asking you to present to us is what else needs to happen at your organization that you were unable to do because of closures, and then what's your anticipated timeline for meeting that? So for example, we heard from a lot of you institutes of higher education that have to work within governance structures that you had governance meetings that were planned for right now that are no longer happening. Okay, so when are you planning on doing that? Do you have something scheduled for October? What are some of those different steps that you need to take in order to get everything into the shape so that by the following calendar year or school year, candidates will be experiencing a reflection of these expectations? We'll also then engage in a conversation around that just to help make sure that we're understanding where you're at and thinking through any potential challenges that might occur. You saw in there that we're asking for that again by August 17th, but if you're wanting to connect with us, I'm just realizing I have a typo here. It says August 2017. It meant to say August 17th, 2020. I assume you all know that. And again, I can't see the chat, so I'm not sure if you were already chatting me that typo, but that is a typo. This plan would also need to be by August 17th, 2020. But if you want to have a conversation before that, as you're trying to navigate through what this might look like, how to approach it, reach out to us and we can talk. Additionally, if you're concerned about other, we've tried to be as responsive as possible in our guidance and in issuing the expectations that we have. If you have ongoing concerns around this guidance or around what this means, we need to know in order to determine what, how to continue moving forward. And the best way to let us know is to reach out and to schedule a time to chat. I've connected with so many of you already over the past month. It's crazy that it's only been a month. But I know that we've connected a ton over the past month. But for those of you for which we haven't yet connected, or if you have additional concerns, certainly reach out, let us know. We can schedule a time to chat. The other piece that was kind of connected to this in the Friday guidelines and that we wanted to provide an update around is the MTEL tests. So in the SMK implementation memo that is posted on our website from 2018, there is a timeline for the MTEL processes. This timeline has been updated And is being additionally impacted by the current situation that we're in, the MTEL test closures, and really wanting to make sure that we're being thoughtful, for example, of individuals who registered for a test to be taken in April, thinking that they were taking one test, wanting to make sure that we are being taking note of that as we move forward with the ongoing timeline. So this timeline that's listed here, it is tentative. So I want to emphasize that, bolded and italicized here. This is what we're currently working towards, but as we know, things can shift and change as we move forward. A couple of things to note within this is that Group A and Group B right now are, again, tentatively going to be operational in winter of 2021. Group A had originally been kind of scheduled for this summer, or this spring even, and so that's being pushed out. Additionally, Group D is being pushed out into spring 2020, which was originally going to be earlier, about, I think, by spring 21. And so just take note that these timelines have been updated here. The test objectives, and as you know, the MTEL test objectives are what the test items are actually based off of. The test objectives for Group A, Group B, and Group C are currently on our website. So if you have individuals who are going to be taking the Math 5-8 assessment later on, likely after winter 2021, and you want to know what's on those test objectives, you can go and see them on our website right now. The other piece that I just wanted to bring up here, and it's come up a bit in conversation around these MTEL test update timelines, the SMK implementations that are happening in your own programs, and I kind of noted it on the previous slide, but that difference between the functional knowledge that is being assessed by MTEL, a level of functional knowledge, which means I know this content, versus fluency in that content knowledge, which is signaling I know how to well teach this content. That is what you all are doing in prep, making sure that people have the fluency of content knowledge such that they're able to well teach it. Meanwhile, the MTELs are assessing a functional understanding of that knowledge, which is not just applicable for your candidates, but is also the gate that we have for provisionally licensed educators who are coming into our system. We need to have some level of assurance that they've got that functional knowledge to be able to go and teach our kids. And having these updates happen as soon as possible is reflective of wanting to make sure that folks who are demonstrating that functional knowledge on MTEL is reflective of the current Massachusetts curriculum frameworks within each of those subjects. And so we know that this presents a challenge for you all in preparation programs as folks are moving through their programs at different timelines and what it means based on the MTEL, but are hopeful that in the updates that you're making, you're really focusing on how do you get your candidates to that level of fluency and content knowledge, and then navigating these MTEL timelines in terms of the tests accordingly. And it looks like there are some chats coming in, but again, I'm not looking at them right now. So Megan, if you want to address any of them right now, please hop in. Otherwise, I'll keep us moving and then we'll come back to them. So still on the MTEL piece a little bit, but moving a bit more into the explicitly related to licensure considerations. Test centers are closed. We know that they're closed. We know that that presents an issue. We got some questions around how we're navigating that. And what we can say is that we're working actively to navigate the different avenues that we can for potential statutory flexibility for individuals who are being explicitly impacted by not being able to take and pass MTELs, and as a result are not having access to any licenses. Because as you know, in Massachusetts, if you've not passed the appropriate MTELs, you don't have access to any of our licenses. That said, it's still TBD. We will be sure to update you as soon as we possibly can. There were also some questions around whether MTEL might be able to be taken at home, online, or in other situations. We, at this time, we don't have any information to share, except that we are exploring all options available with our vendor, and will absolutely update you if there is any new information on that end. On a similar note, but on a different angle, we've been talking for the last several months about a potential MTEL alternative pilot. So back in January, we went in front of the board to propose some regulatory language change that would allow us to pilot the potential of alternative approaches beyond the MTEL. Including, and again, a couple questions around this, including potentially accepting other assessments alongside the MTEL COMLIT, and then also allowing, potentially having a pilot where we might allow ed prep programs to certify that content-specific knowledge, even if an individual has not passed their MTEL. All of that is currently on hold. We were supposed to go in front of the board this month. We are not going in front of the board this month. And therefore, they have not yet voted on the updated regulatory language that would allow us to pursue these pilots. So you can check our board meeting schedules on our website if you're interested as we move forward to identify when we're able to get in front of them again. But we will be sure also to update you if and as things come up into updates around that. There were also some questions on the licensure office and how they might navigate things given potential surges in applications at different times. They have expressed with us that they're not anticipating any impacts. They've got systems in place to be able to support the ongoing needs. They process thousands of applications during their busy season and have, again, the structures in place to be able to navigate within that. So we're not anticipating any impacts on that end, but they have recommended that if you have individuals who are ready to apply for licensure sooner rather than later, that they should go ahead and do so because they are standing by and ready to help support that process. Additionally, there was a question around if you have a teacher who's currently on a waiver who can't demonstrate, can't pass the MTEL right now, how might they be able to stay teaching on a waiver as a teacher of record in a public school? There are multiple ways to demonstrate the continuous progress that you would need to demonstrate to be able to maintain a waiver. And so there's a website here that you can go to in our licensure office to see what those different ways are that they can demonstrate. So you can talk them through that, but ultimately they'd have to work with the district to determine what the district would be comfortable with advocating for on their behalf. The ad license process, again, we've talked about this a couple of times, but just wanted to reiterate here some guidance that we shared on Tuesday. If an individual has a bachelor's degree and they've passed the MTEL, they can apply for a provisional license. Before you endorse them for a separate initial license that you are working with them on. And so while that would not lead to multiple initial licenses as they might otherwise be working towards with you as you endorse them for one initial and support them with an ad license process, it could still help them demonstrate that they've got content, they've taken coursework, they've passed MTELs in that additional area. Separately, but again connected, if they completed a 150-hour internship that you usually sign off on for them, that could be signed off by the district if they got those hours under that district leader supervision as well. Again, outside of kind of the current situation that we're within. So those are kind of your routes here for the ad license if you're not able to support them with 150 hours of field experience after schools were closed. And then this is all, I actually already noted this on the previous slide, but around a potential for some type of emergency license that would be available to individuals who would otherwise not be able to complete test or coursework requirements is something that we are actively seeking out and trying to identify ways that we might be able to work within that, but we are bound by statutory requirements here. And so, are kind of working on the avenues there to see what might be possible. We will update you if anything becomes available. So this is my last slide before I stop and take questions. So thank you for bearing with me. I can't see your faces, I can't see your chat. So kind of going in the dark here. The last set of questions that came in were about, again, not just this semester and folks who are going to complete right now, but what are we doing moving forward in terms of fall and longer term implications on this? So I've captured here some of the questions that came up. What happens if schools and campuses are open and closed periodically throughout next year? Right now, a lot of you would otherwise be securing your pre-prac and your practicum placements, but you're not able to engage with districts in that way. And it's possible that even if schools are open in the fall, they might not be as open to working with teacher candidates as they have been previously. What will remote teaching look like? Will there be ongoing flexibility for you all to be exercising judgment on readiness? What about MTELs? What about moving your coursework online? What does asynchronous learning mean versus synchronous learning? Currently, our guidance issue around online learning is not always super explicit, but we are asking you to let us know if you're moving to an online setting. And so this is all put here without answers because we are currently engaging in some thinking around that. Really appreciate the questions and the conversations that we are happening with you all because they are essential for us to understand how things are being impacted on your end. given the regulatory language that we currently have in place and the way that our program approval guidelines are laid out, it allowed us to be really nimble and act quickly a month ago when all of this started happening so that we could issue updated policy and guidance for this semester. And so what you've seen us share with you so far is a result of us coming together and saying, we need to come up with some guidance pretty quickly, address the concerns that are coming up for right now. But as we think longer term, as we think about the ongoing potential impact that this is going to be having on you and your candidates, we want to make sure that we're thinking about that with a bit of a longer term view on that, rather than just staying grounded in immediately what do we do right now with our candidates who are immediately impacted. And so we're going to continue engaging with our in our ongoing processes that we have. We engage with the MACD board, we engage with SCOPE, which are the deans of our public institutions. We engage with ComTech. We've been hosting these weekly open meetings to have conversations. So all of those pieces are going to take place. We might also be seeking additional ways to pull together some folks to help us think through, again, with a bit more agility and digging deeply into these questions of what do we do looking forward in terms of the longer term implications. So stay posted on that, but please, again, as things continue to come up that you have on your mind and that would be helpful to get additional information around, let us know so that we can be thinking through what that might look like. So with that, I'm going to stop sharing my screen so that I can see your faces and the chats. And open it up to questions. Sandra, Megan, it looks like you've been responding to some, so I'm going to hand it off to you.
Yep, so I've been answering some, so I'm going to assume that I've answered your question in writing, unless you have a follow-up, in which case you can raise your hand and we can take that verbally. There are a few, Sandra, that I didn't get to, so we'll ask of you now. Can you share a timeline for the transcript verification option for BAC programs?
Timeline for transcript verification.
I think in ELAR, you mentioned that we were working with IT and licensure.
Oh, sorry, for bachelor verification?
Yeah.
Sorry, I thought you said transcript verification.
That is, but I think that's
the timeline for bachelor verification. Within the next couple of weeks, we've got some drafted guidance. And the next step from that is for us to review how does this look, and then turning to a couple of folks, probably a couple of folks on this call to say, hey, can you review this guideline or this guidance, these instructions? Do they make sense? Can you do some UAT testing with us so that we can launch it? We know that semesters are coming to a close and that endorsements will be happening very soon. And so we know that it is going to be most helpful if it happens within the next couple of weeks. So that's what we're aiming for.
Sandra, can I ask a question? Just about that, is there a problem with doing the electronic endorsements on ELAR right now?
Absolutely not. If you are ready to endorse them, you can absolutely endorse them. The bachelor verification process is not something that will have to be used. That will be a possibility to replace an official bachelor's degree transcript online. So if you're ready to endorse right now, by all means, go ahead.
Okay, thanks.
Yep.
A question just came in from Laura around why can't the second license internships, I think specifically for the ad license feature, be allowed to do online service delivery. Our students are grappling with providing services to students with disabilities in inclusive classrooms, and they're often more forward thinking than the school.
Yeah, so I think the piece here is whether the 150 hours that are required that would be signed off by you as a sponsoring organization or by districts, the superintendent there on the district, because that's the other route for it, are truly representative of what a teacher would be generally doing within that 150-hour internship. And right now, the discrepancy across districts and what's happening in terms of virtual learning and in terms of virtual settings makes it a bit hard to understand whether hours completed in a virtual setting are as reflective of those 150 hours as they would be if they were being conducted within a classroom setting as they normally are. That said, if you have specific questions around that, encourage you to email us at the EdPrep inbox and we will forward it along to licensure directly, as the licensure office are the ones who process all of those transcript review or the intern verification forms and would respond if they have additional questions on that end. So if you have additional specific questions, we'll need to engage our licensure office with that. And so ask that you email EdPrep and then we'll forward it along to our licensure colleagues.
Next question is from Neil Teague. What should program supervisors enter in the CAP cover form where it says, have any portions of the program been waived? Should they describe all the parts of CAP that were not done or just if the hours were waived?
Sorry, there is, if any portions have been waived, I would say yes, like indicate.
You're muted, Sandra.
Sorry about that. If you're using the CAP online platform, there's not a place to indicate what specifically was waived. It's a purely check yes or no, was it waived? If so, check yes. If not, then there's nothing. If you're using the CAP, the paper documentation, you can certainly add there at a high level what it is that was waived. We still consider that separate from the data collection that we'll be collecting around what specific issues were waived. And then again, that's separate from your own file processes that you have in place around if you've waived something, what components you have there. So I would say there that whatever your process is going to be for maintaining the full set of what has been waived and why, you should follow that. There's nothing specific as it relates to the CAP form that we are looking for, but we assume that most folks will have the box checked this year, given that most folks who were endorsed this semester have had some component waived.
Sandra, we're all caught up, I think, on questions from above. So now they're coming in real time and okay. Happy to have you just read them. Sure. I'll just note that our intention is to post this slide deck on the EdPrep COVID-19 website so that it's available to everyone. And it looks like Janet or somebody else from MACD is also recording this. So your call on what to do with that, but we'll post the slide deck.
Thank you. So Marianne, you're asking about cross-cutting SMKs not being measured by an MTEL. That is correct. The cross-cutting SMKs are expected to be incorporated into all initial teacher licensure programs. And as such, they are not being assessed by any one MTEL, but rather the expectation is that they're embedded into your programs and that you are ensuring that folks are demonstrating that those cross-cutting SMKs throughout your program. There are some, like the digital literacy side of things, that if you are taking a DLCS MTEL eventually, then that component is obviously going to be incorporated into that MTEL. But the cross-cutting SMKs in and of themselves are not being additionally allocated into each MTEL. And then Amy asking about hours, should you capture the number of hours completed in the physical classroom and then the number of virtual hours? They can be counted in total. I think that, again, on the CAP cover form, the way that you're documenting the hours, let me step back a sec. This semester, we know that there are regulatory requirements for hours. Oftentimes, organizations go well above and beyond those required hours for practicum experiences. This semester, we are not looking as closely at practicum hours, specific hours. Instead, we're thinking about the experiences that individuals have had and the opportunities that they're having to demonstrate their skills throughout their program. And so then my answer again is no, you don't need to separate it out. If it's helpful for you to separate it out, you certainly can. If the virtual hours are conducted in a format that is not with their supervising practitioner and with the students that they were engaging in their practicum around, I think that's where things get a little bit different, right? So if I'm continuing with my practicum experience with my supervising practitioner, with the same students, and I'm doing virtual learning with them in this kind of a platform, those experiences are different than if I'm working with a completely different set of students virtually, if I'm working one-on-one with students virtually, who again, were not a part of that class. And so really just ask that you approach that in the way that makes sense to you and your organization with your candidates. And again, just as a reminder for the cross-cutting SMKs, they are applicable to all initial licensure teachers. So they're not required for specialist teachers like reading specialist, but if you're an initially licensed art educator, if you're initially licensed music educator, those cross-cutting SMKs are still should still be reflective in your program. And so that's, for example, a difference in terms of making sure that the candidates are ready to meet the needs of English learners. A music teacher doesn't need to get an SEI endorsement, but we do anticipate that music teachers are going to be engaging in classes of students who include English learners. And so thinking about what does it mean to meet the needs of English learners within my music setting is still something that we would want you to be covering within your coursework. Mary Beth asking about optic videos and availability at no cost in the fall for you and your teacher candidates. So yes, this week we hosted two optic demos for folks. I think we had in total about 85 different individuals who participated in those to be thinking about incorporating the optic platform into your pre-practicum experience, as in particular as it relates to providing opportunities for classroom observation virtually that you can then calibrate around. So through some amazing advocacy from my colleague, Claire, who led those webinars, we were able to access the platform for another year for free. So it's been free for about the past year and a half. They're extending that out one more year. So until June 30th of 2021, any sponsoring organization can have full access to that platform at no cost. And we're hoping again that you might be able to leverage that in particular as you're impacted by not being able to get into classrooms and see candidates and teachers in action. There will be a cost after that, and so we've got pricing information. We have a video recording of the session that we recorded, so if you are interested in getting that, just email our EdPrep inbox, and we will send you the recording and the other resources that we have related to that. Megan, it looks like you answered Marilyn's question. I'm going to hop over it into Michelle's. You've been approached by a partner district to have your candidates work one-on-one with students who need some support via remote learning with oversight from the partner district. You want to help them. Would we discourage this or since it would allow candidates to gain additional experience? In some cases, districts are not as open to allowing the candidate as much involvement in a virtual environment. Your thoughts? I think, yeah, absolutely. If you can work with additional districts, if you can work with additional schools, again, like folks are getting creative and innovative, certainly do that in whatever way makes sense. I think that this, you know, it's really started opening different kinds of conversations around partnerships with pre-K-12 schools and districts and the ways that we've been talking about partnerships so much for the last couple of years. And so it might be an opportunity to establish some new partnerships in places that you haven't historically had them. I know that there are some virtual schools, a couple of virtual schools out there that have just been establishing new partnerships with organizations at this point as well as a result of the situation that we're currently in. Let's see here. So for the cap on for cap data reporting, what is going to happen if you don't have summative and formative? Given the guidance that we've provided that you only need to have summative ratings, we know that in some cases, or in many cases, you will have candidates who don't have two different sets of ratings. We're still trying to navigate within the nuance of how that needs to be consumed within our systems and how that will be impacting reports. So stay tuned for guidance on that. But as long as you have summative ratings or formative ratings that where the candidate demonstrated readiness, so you're not repeating a second set of ratings, that will work and will provide you guidance with how to upload it accordingly. Language of waivers from Shannon. If your program requires far more than the required 300, do we write the waiver for the total number of hours we're waiving from our own program requirements or only waiving any hours up until 300? So if you require 400, they completed 200. Yeah, so The waivers in particular, in terms of the data collection as well, that we want to have on file is to make sure that we're understanding where you are waiving things beyond what is typically required according to our regulations. So our regulations require, in most cases, 300 hours of practicum experience with 100 hours of full responsibility. So Shannon, in your case, if you want to note just the 100 hours, that is certainly within like the expectations given what our regulatory requirements are. If it's easier on your end to say 200 hours like of 400, you can also include that. See here. Cross-cutting SMKs. For licensing fields, its frameworks are still being updated. So PE and health, do cross-cutting SMKs need to be included by September 2020? Or are those programs expected to be revised? That's a great question, Marianne. So for those of you who don't know, there are a couple of curriculum frameworks that are still actively in the works, and namely the health curriculum frameworks. I think in that case, if you are holding on, I'm sorry, I should have a more concrete answer to this. If you're holding off on making the full updates until it's fully reflective of those programs, and some of the updates that you're making to your other courses are not naturally kind of colliding with that, then you can just indicate that in a note on your statement of assurance. Will the CAP platform in the future feature the new element around content knowledge? Yes. So the candidate assessment of performance element around subject matter knowledge is something that is going to be incorporated into the platform beginning this fall. So before the beginning of the school year, it's currently in the works right now. The challenge is we can't have two iterations of the platform up. So we didn't want to make that live in the CAP online platform until everyone is closed out the cycles that you're in right now. So it is still anticipated to be coming this summer. I think August, beginning of August right now, is to hopefully capture everyone and close out those cycles before we start up the new ones. The paper forms are currently updated on our website right now in the CAP handbook. And so you can access those forms on the paper forms right now. If all elements during pre-practicum are through videos, simulations, or virtual with no face-to-face student contact, will this be acceptable? Lisa, I think this is one of those questions that gets into the thinking about fall and thinking about where we are at in the fall. So I'm gonna hold off a bit on a response to that in the fall. The kind of guidance that I've been giving to individuals who are engaging their pre-practicum right now, who are not engaging in their pre-practicum right now because they are no in that stage two pre-practicum where they're putting into the practice with real students, which is, and I'm saying that different than virtually, right? Because I would consider synchronous virtual situations to be similar as in-person interactions because it's still live with real people in front of you. If that didn't happen and a candidate is going into their practicum placement in the fall and they're working with real students in the fall, I would encourage you to consider some of those like really early fall practicum experiences as pre-practicum in terms of making sure that you're getting those loops of engagement with them around how that's going for them early on in the fall, if they were supposed to have had them in the semester and in the summer and in a way that they haven't. Terry, about master's degree, verifying a master's degree is a great idea. I think that might be an exchange that's happening. So I'm gonna skip over that. Ryan, speech pathology licensure program. Should they complete the waiver spreadsheet? So speech pathology, as well as school psychology are approved via a national accreditation processes that we accept in place of or alongside our DESE expectations. And so, yes, Ryan, part of what we're trying to do in this waiver collection process is understand the extent and the impact of the current situation on candidates' experiences. So I would say two things there. One, yes, please do include them in that documentation. And two, please make sure that you're connecting with those accreditation processes to ensure that what you're doing is also in alignment with that accreditation process as well. Danielle's asking how folks are counting online teaching hours when they are asynchronous. That's a good question that I'll pose to others. Again, I would say for the purposes of ours right now, and knowing that the intent of the practicum is for teachers to get as much of a real licensure type experience as they would otherwise have if they were in that licensure role and working with candidates, those asynchronous hours don't feel as reflective of pre-K-12 in-person engagements that teachers would normally be engaging in. So for the purpose of this semester, where hours are a little bit more fluid and we're not counting them in the exact same way, certainly be flexible around that. But as we move forward, again, I think that's going to be one of the questions that we'll have to continue to consider what impacts are if this is in a longer term setting. Yeah, so Bev asking about, can you move beyond Massachusetts and having students go away from Massachusetts, work with students at home? For this semester, we have said yes. Any kind of practicum expectations that should generally be happening in Massachusetts public schools or in schools that use the Massachusetts curriculum frameworks, that is a component that can be waived. As we start thinking about longer term implications, we might have a different set of guidance around that. So for now and in this semester, yes, absolutely. Moving forward into next year, we're going to have to revisit whether that's the same guidance we provide. Michelle asking about trying to count in real time. Oh, thanks. You're responding to Danielle's question. Appreciate it. Did somebody submit a question in the chat that has not yet been responded to by myself or by Megan? If so, I ask that you come off of mute or type it in so that we make sure that we capture it. Yeah, Charmaine, it looks like Bev was referencing pre-prac. The intent is still that candidates are engaging with the expectations of practicum settings here in Massachusetts. We're going to maybe need to be more flexible on that end as it relates to pre-prac as well. We don't have a set number of hours where people need to be engaging in pre-prac, but we want to ensure that it's scaffolded and working towards what the expectations will be here in Massachusetts. Michelle, I appreciate the boldness of your question whether we anticipate schools are going to return on May 4th. I have as much information as you all have via the news, and it sounds as though there might be some additional guidance coming out from our governor early next week. That is the extent that I know. Oh, Shelly, I'm so sorry about the broken arm. What a time to be also navigating a broken arm. I hope that it gets better very soon. That is a good question for us to note in terms of, again, the future. At this point, I don't want to indicate at all what we'll be requiring, expecting, relating waivers in the future, just because we haven't gotten there yet. But that's something that we'll keep in mind.
I think the only other thing I would just add to the conversation around pre-prac is a note on the guidance and approach that we took to those pre-prac expectations is that there is not an hour requirement associated with pre-practicum. There's a set of activities and an approach to engaging in the pre-practicum that should create assurances for you and for the candidate that going into the practicum, there's a certain level of readiness, but there aren't confirmed set of hours associated with the pre-practicum. So just wanted to make sure that that was clear.
Bev, could you say a little bit more? Let them start fall and out of.
Yeah, I'm trying to type and ask questions and read everyone's questions. So we have a situation where our particular early childhood program is an undergraduate program, and so many of the students don't live in Massachusetts and they've already gone home. And this is the time that we actually set out the pre-prac guidelines and the handbook and tell them to start getting ready for it. And everyone is super, super anxious. And some of them have asked whether if local daycare centers in their hometowns, et cetera, open up, they're worried that number one, the university might not open, so they might not get back here in the fall. Mm-hmm. They also worry that schools might not open, the same across all states. So they were hoping, because the way US does it, the fall they do their pre-K placement, and then in the spring they do their 1-2 placement. So they do it's not a dual license at all, it's a single license, but yeah. They do those full semesters and they sort of do a baby cap in the fall and then a full cap in the spring. Mm-hmm. And that gives them their 100 and their 200 hours. Mm-hmm. So what our early childhood person asked us this morning was, could she give them the set of criteria that they would normally follow in that first placement, and she would vet the placement. So somebody would type her and say, I'm going to go sit at my mother's baby, yeah. My mother's children. That's a little different than going to the local creche or the local preschool.
But I'll jump in now to say, yes, thank you for clarifying. That's something that I would say, again, given this current semester, if they were engaging in split practicum in that sense, it falls within our existing guidance for this semester. We have not yet issued, again, the guidance for what it will look like next year, but we'll certainly continue to take that kind of question into consideration in terms of that. Especially because, as we know, again, several IHEs have indicated that your campuses might remain virtual in the fall. And so what does that mean for your individuals who don't live in Massachusetts as well?
Thank you.
Linda, I appreciate your push around reconceptualizing what it means to be in the role of a teacher. That is absolutely something that our current teachers are experiencing very, very concretely right now. And I think on Tuesday, somebody had mentioned a similar comment of not wanting to undermine the awesome skills that your teacher candidates have been developing in this time as it relates to remote teaching in a way that they otherwise would not necessarily have had the situation not been in place. And so synchronous and asynchronous teaching are absolutely being expected of our current pre-K-12 educators. And again, as we think longer term, might be something that current teachers are going to have to continue engaging within. So I just want to name that I appreciate the push, and it's something that we know that we need to think about a little bit more deeply and issue more guidance around, because it's not something that had previously come up. Previously, even when teachers were having their practicum settings in the virtual schools, we were being really cautious around, yes, a practicum setting in a virtual school can be really helpful and set them up for that setting, but to what extent does that also set them up for an in-person setting that they would then be eligible for with that license? And so lots of thinking, and again, in building out our conceptualization of things. I appreciate it. Thank you.
If there are no more questions, should we say goodbye? And thank you so very much for taking this time to give us new insights and more to think about.
Thank you, Sandra.
All so much.
Thank you, Janet.
Thanks for submitting questions. We will be online on Tuesday at 10 if additional things come up. Also, reach out with an email if you want to set up a time to chat about the SMK pre-prac, about other things that are going on that you want to talk through. We appreciate you and all that you're doing, and hope that you stay healthy and well.
Thanks.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And I'll see what we can do about sending the recording, putting it someplace that people can get it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.